manuscripts of the Talmud. Much of the evidence is collected in Robert Van Voorst's Jesus Outside the New Testament, although note that his data is inaccurate. More references exist in the Talmud than he collects, and many of the passages he cites actually have had references to Jesus expunged from them by Christian scribes. When we look at more reliable manuscripts, Jesus of Nazareth is repeatedly and explicitly identified as Jesus ben Pantera and Jesus ben Stada, leaving no such doubts as Van Voorst voices about their equivalents. Elsewhere, we learn that this Jesus, who practiced magic and led Israel astray, was stoned and crucified on the day before Passover. In some manuscripts of the Talmud, it even says on a Sabbath eve, in both respects, corresponding to the timeline in the Gospel of John, which actually agrees with Jewish law. The other Gospels depict an impossible event, an execution on a high holy day. This Jesus was also known as Ben Stada, meaning son of the unfaithful, a woman named Mary, who committed adultery with her lover Pandera. Most likely that means Panthera, or Panther, a popular nickname for Roman soldiers, as this was the Jewish polemic as reported in the 2nd century, and thus gave birth to Ben Stada, who was thus also known as Ben Pandera, which may be a pun on Ben Parthenos, son of the Virgin, a pun that was already part of Jewish anti-Christian polemic in the 2nd century, based on the legend of a Roman soldier named Panther being the real father of Jesus, as confirmed by Celsus and Origen, and therefore Ben Stada is indeed our Jesus. Although in the Talmudic account, he is tried and executed in Lydda, not Jerusalem. And not only do some manuscripts of the Talmud include on the Sabbath eve, they also include the phrase Jesus the Nazarene in many of the passages Van Voorst presents as lacking it, because it was later deleted by Christian scribes from the manuscripts Van Voorst derives his texts from. Van Voorst insists Ben Stada is not our Jesus, but none of his arguments are valid. The stoned were always crucified, hanged, under Jewish law. Thus, there are not two different executions being described. Nor does the account of Jesus' stoning, the one Van Voorst agrees is about Jesus, say he was not stoned in Lydda or not tried before the Beth Din, the Jewish High Court. So there is no contradiction between these accounts, as Van Voorst claims. And the fact that these accounts contradict the canonical Gospels is precisely the point. Even the passages Van Voorst agrees are about Jesus contradict the Gospels we have, so he doesn't even obey his own logic. But the point is that here we have knowledge of a completely different Gospel tradition placing Jesus the Nazarene, apostate, son of the Virgin Mary, under Alexander Janias, with a different crucifixion account occurring in a different location. That Ben Stada is Jesus the Nazarene is further entailed by the fact that he is explicitly called Ben Pandera, and described as the son of Mary, who cheated on her husband with Pandera. Facts that are explicitly part of known Jewish polemic about Jesus and make no sense in any other way. That he was also executed on the day before Passover, indeed on the Sabbath eve, and condemned for sorcery and leading Israelites astray, which latter crime was allegedly confirmed, at least in Jewish polemic, by spies, possibly those called false witnesses in our Gospels, only confirms the conclusion that this is the same person. Van Voorst sees a contradiction between the one Talmudic account of there being witnesses for the prosecution and the other Talmudic account claiming no witnesses could be found for his defense, but it should be obvious that that entails no contradiction. Not that it matters. What is said about Ben Stada could be ignored entirely. The apostate Jesus under Janias is still explicitly identified as Jesus the Nazarene and as being stoned and crucified on the day before the Passover, on a Sabbath eve even, for practicing magic and leading Israel astray. So we clearly see that the Jews who compiled the Babylonian Talmud only knew of a Jesus executed under Janias, not any Jesus executed under Pilate. And Epiphanius confirms that some Torah-observant Christians, from the original sect of Christianity, actually did preach that. So there was some sort of gospel circulating in the East, from a more conservative and faithful descendant of the original Christian sect, that narrated a Jesus born of the Virgin Mary, as the Jewish polemic in the Talmud entails these Christians were claiming, in Bethlehem, according to the Christians themselves who adopted this version of events, and executed under Janias for working miracles and, quote-unquote, leading people astray. How can the descendants of the original sect of Christians have come to believe Jesus lived and died 100 years before our Gospels say he did. It is nearly impossible to imagine how such a doctrine could have developed, unless there was no historical Jesus. Then he could be placed in history wherever each sect desired. In other words, if originally Jesus was not placed in history, then when he was placed in history, after the sects had split, ideologically and geographically, each sect could place him differently, developing their own myths in accord with their own needs and creativity. That would then influence neighboring sects and daughter sects connected with them. But if this was done twice, in separate regions, once inside the Roman Empire and once outside, those could have become the seeds of two different traditions, spreading and developing independently of each other. Even in the West, there was not an established date or narrative for Jesus. Already, of course, no one could agree on when Jesus was born, Matthew placing his birth under Herod the Great, Luke under Quirinius, more than 10 years later. And they also couldn't agree in what year he was killed, John placing the event the day before the Passover of either 30 or 33 AD, the Synoptics during the Passover of 27 or 34 AD. But those kinds of confusions or distortions would not be too surprising, even for a historical man, about whom such confusions or distortions could arise. A bit more surprising is the fact that they couldn't agree on who executed Jesus. The Romans, at the command of Pontius Pilate, as the canonical Gospels claim, or the Jews, at the command of King Herod Antipas, as the Gospel of Peter claims, and as some hints even in canonical sources could be taken to suggest, for example, Acts 5 verse 30 in combination with Galatians 3 verse 13, and even the interpolation in 1 Thessalonians 2 verses 15 to 16. Curiously, Luke alone inserts this Herod into the story by adapting a story originally told about Pilate in Mark, Mark 15 verses 15 to 20, becoming Luke 23 verse 11. A Herod is not in any way involved in Jesus' trial or death in any other gospel account. See Mark 14 and 15, Matthew 26 and 27, and John 18 and 19. But in the Gospel of Peter, not only is he as involved as Luke imagines, but he is the one who executes Jesus, not Pilate. And yet this gospel was popular in the East before our familiar canon came to replace it. Serapion, bishop of Antioch, discovered the Gospel of Peter was a principal text used in some Eastern churches, but when he finally read it, he deemed it heretical and had the text banned sometime near the end of the 2nd century. Also surprising is the fact noted earlier that many early Christians thought Jesus died in the reign of Emperor Claudius rather than Emperor Tiberius, between whom reigned Caligula from 37 to 41. Claudius reigned 41 to 54. They mistakenly thought Pontius Pilate was governing Judea at the same time, even though he had been deposed by Tiberius in 36. But they were sure it was in the 40s that Jesus was killed, not the 30s, and their reasons are telling. Irenaeus says that it was in accordance with prophecy that King Herod and Caesar's man Pilate would do this. Quote, "For Herod the king of the Jews and Pontius Pilate, the governor of Claudius Caesar, came together and condemned him to be crucified. For Herod feared as though Jesus really were to be an earthly king, lest he should be expelled by him from the kingdom. But Pilate was constrained by Herod and the Jews that were with him against his will to deliver him to death, for they threatened him, asking if he should not rather do this than act contrary to Caesar by letting go a man who is called a king." End quote. Notably, this does not correspond to any known gospel. In the canonicals, Herod does not threaten Pilate with this argument, although the Jews in general do, but only in John 19. And Herod never expresses any such fear, although Herod the Great did 40 years earlier, according to Matthew 2, and never condemns Jesus to be crucified at all, much less together with Pilate, as if in the same court, although something similar does occur in the Gospel of Peter. Thus, even such an orthodoxist as Irenaeus could not agree on the narrative. More importantly, Irenaeus was doing scriptural math here, not history. His reasoning was that Jesus had to have been nearly 50 when he died because John 8 verse 57 said so, and yet was around 30 in the year 29 AD because Luke 3 said so. So he had to have died in the 40s AD and therefore in the reign of Claudius. But this is precisely the kind of methodology that generates myths and legends. If similar calculations determined that Scripture declared the Christ had to have died in the time of Pilate, as we know they easily could, as we saw in Element 7, then that is where myth would place him. Matching that math differently to the facts would produce a different period to place him in, as we saw the original authors of Daniel intended, and there were yet other ways the same calculations could be run. But the problem of where to put him in history, which was just as easily answered for every other euhemerized demigod in antiquity, as we saw in Element 45, could also be solved by the obvious logic of placing him at the imagined founding of the city or institution that worships him. That is why the mythical Romulus was placed in history at the founding of Rome. Jesus, then, would most naturally fit into history at the founding of the church. From the letters of Paul, we know that that was most likely the late 30s AD. Paul's new sect was certainly launched then, but so was the original Torah observant sect not long before, if that is indeed when the first revelations of Jesus occurred, which is what 1 Corinthians 15 claims, Peter, that is, Kephas, being the first revelator, contemporary with Paul, according to 1 Corinthians 1 verse 12, 3 verse 22, 9 verse 5, and Galatians 1 verse 18 and 2 verses 9 to 14. And indeed, those revelations might themselves have been inspired by calculations from Daniel, producing an exuberant expectation that something new would be revealed about this mysterious dying Christ any time now. In that scenario, the revelations came first, the euhemerizing myth came later. Why another offshoot of the original Christian sect decided to place him instead 100 years earlier, we cannot so easily deduce, because we don't have their gospels and epistles, and thus we can't reconstruct their logic the way we can for the sect whose texts we do have. All we know is that they did, indeed, place him 100 years earlier. Epiphanius may be providing us a clue, however, since in his account, their scriptural math appears to have been based on the assumption that somehow Scripture ordained that the Messiah would come when the last king died who could claim descent from David. They had concluded that that was Alexander Janias. Therefore, Jesus had to have appeared then, either actually or allegorically for the purposes of their exoteric myth. They might also have been deriving the date from Daniel, employing a different scheme than Christians in the West did. Either would reflect a similar mindset to Irenaeus, and a similar disinterest in actual facts. Of course, if Jesus actually lived in the 30s, then that would also explain why our Gospels place him there. But it would not explain why another branch of Christianity, which stayed closer to its original teachings, placed him 100 years before that. The hypothesis that Jesus didn't exist, however, can explain both facts, and with more ease. As a general rule, it must surely be more common for a mythical man to be placed in different historical periods than for this to happen to a historical man, for whom there would only be one core tradition originating from his own time, well known to his worshippers and tradents. I have no data on the relative frequency of this phenomenon. How many people do we know to have been set in different historical periods? How many of them never existed to begin with? What would those numbers then be in a hypothetical infinite repetition of history? But it must surely beg all credulity to believe that this happens to historical persons exactly as often as non-historical ones, even for the simple reason that it is so much easier to do this to non-historical persons. As I noted before, if there is no actual set of historical events anchoring that person to reality, then they can easily be inserted into history wherever any given mythographer wants. This must surely be harder to do for a man already solidly linked to his actual historical context, and widely known to be so among all who worshipped him. In mathematical terms, this would mean the ratio must be greater than 2 to 1. In other words, being placed in different historical periods must happen to mythical persons twice as often as it happens to historical persons, at least. In fact, more than twice, surely. But I am committed to erring as far against the mythicist hypothesis as is reasonably possible, so I will assume this ratio to be only 2 to 1. That means the consequent probability of this fact, of Jesus being placed in both the 30s AD and the 70s BC, on the hypothesis of myth, is twice the consequent probability of this same fact on the hypothesis of historicity. And so we can treat the consequent probability on historicity as 0.5 and the consequent probability on myth as 1. For example, if this happens to 1 in a million historical persons I'm saying we'll find it happens to at least 2 in a million mythical persons. For consequent probabilities of 0.000001 and 0.000002, respectively, which just simply gives an odds ratio of 2 to 1 in favor of myth. We can reduce those consequences to 1 and 0.5 by canceling out the coefficient of contingency. This does not mean the probability that E on H is literally 50%, as if every other historical person were placed in different periods of history, or that the probability that E on not H is literally 100%, as if every mythical person were placed in different periods of history. Rather, this is simply their relative probabilities, after a mathematical reduction. No matter what the consequent probabilities actually are, in other words, no matter how many historical or mythical persons this actually happens to, they will always reduce to 0.5 and 1 if it happens twice as often to mythical persons as historical. Therefore, if that ratio is a warranted belief, then we don't need to know the actual frequencies, because whatever they are, they will always reduce to that same ratio. Another way to think of it is that being placed in different periods of history is the sort of thing we expect of a mythical person more than of a historical one, such that if we cancel out the common contingency between them, it is then 100% expected on not H, but only 50% expected on H. In fact, to argue even more a fortiori, I'll allow, even against all reason, that there could be as much as an 80% probability that this would happen to a historical Jesus, which makes the odds 4 to 5, even though I think that's absurd. Either way, this fact is evidence against the historicity of Jesus. Not conclusive evidence, but it counts against, by at least as much as I just stated. Section 2. The Socrates Analogy. To understand the rest of this chapter, it will help to grasp the analogy of Socrates. He is comparable to Jesus in being a famous sage whose influence was profound and everlasting. He is the father of what we now mean by philosophy, in essentially the same way Jesus is of Christianity, without having written anything himself, his influence being entirely through his disciples, who each developed communities that then fragmented and modified his teachings into many competing sects. And yet, Socrates' existence is not in any doubt, nor plausibly doubtable. Why? Because, very much unlike Jesus, we know the names of over a dozen eyewitnesses who wrote books about Socrates. In some cases, we even know the titles of these books, and a number of paraphrases and quotations from them survive in other sources. And in two of those cases, the books even survive. We have the many works of Plato and Xenophon, each of whom was an eyewitness and disciple to Socrates, who each recorded his teachings and reported stories and other information about him. We have nothing at all like this for Jesus. Even more unlike Jesus, we also have an eyewitness account of Socrates from a relatively unfriendly source as well. The Clouds of Aristophanes is a comic play specifically written to poke fun at Socrates and his teachings and disciples, written by an eyewitness contemporary to both. Socrates even sat in the audience of its first production. We have other contemporaries attesting his historical existence in Athens. For example, Aristotle, who knew and cite his personal acquaintances. And we know the names of at least 16 pupils of Socrates who wrote books about him. Principal examples include Aeschines Socraticus, Amypsias, Antisthenes, Aristippus of Cyrene, Sabas of Thebes, not the author, however, of the extant Socratic dialogue forged in his name, Chaerephon, Crito, Euclides, Teleclides, Simmias, Simon the Cobbler, whose shoe shop we've even excavated, Polycrates and Phaedon. See entries for each of these in the Oxford Classical Dictionary. Historians also quickly took notice of Socrates and wrote about him. For example, Idomeneus wrote On the Followers of Socrates about a century after Socrates' death. Even now, the surviving attestations and quotations of Socrates and his witnesses fill 4 volumes. Jesus scholars could only dream of having this much information about Jesus. What we knew of Jesus would be vastly more credible and quantifiable if we had anything even remotely like this for him. Yet we have none of the above. We have no eyewitness records at all, much less from neutral or hostile parties. We don't even know of any written eyewitness accounts ever having existed, much less dozens upon dozens of them. and we certainly don't have anything like identifiable quotations from them or their titles and authors. So why do we have so much better a historical record of what Socrates said and did than we have for Jesus? It is not as if the first century was underrepresented by writers interested in Judean affairs. The unusually high rate of survival of texts from classical Athens is a product of medieval selection, not of any discernible difference in volume of literature produced. And yet, if Socrates had immediately become worshipped as the resurrected Son of God, and his every pronouncement the founding principles of a great church, which went on centuries later to survive as the only institution with the means and interest in preserving materials into the future, we would surely have nearly everything written about him, which would consist of many hundreds of volumes of material, dialogues, discourses, biographies, and memoirs from eyewitnesses, as well as numerous organizational documents, such as wills and deeds and letters among his disciples, which even the illiterate could produce through recourse to hired scribes who were ubiquitously available specifically to serve such a market. In fact, even in the case of Jesus, we can hardly assume no such scribes became disciples or followers soon enough after the mission began to put themselves precisely to such use. A viable theory of historicity for Jesus must therefore instead resemble a theory of historicity for Apollonius of Tyana, or Musonius Rufus, or Judas the Galilean, to list a few very famous men who escaped the expected record in more or less the same degree Jesus did. And yet, unlike for them, that theory cannot involve the claim that records of Jesus existed but weren't preserved out of disinterest, since such records were exactly the sorts of things the many first century churches would preserve, and most such records would certainly still have existed to be preserved by the time of the assembly of Origen's library at the very least, and many would still be around, through continual copying, even in the 4th century and beyond, when the church had increasingly vast resources at its command, situations that never obtained for Apollonius or Musonius or Judas, or even Socrates. So where are all these texts and documents for Jesus? There are really only two options available to the historicist that have any plausibility. One, that Jesus was not at all famous, but in fact so insignificant and uninfluential that he inspired almost no following whatever and was completely unnoticed by any literate person of the age, until and except Paul, though even he didn't know Jesus and showed next to no interest in his actual teachings and story, as we'll see in chapter 11. Or, number two, massive quantities of documents were deliberately destroyed or allowed to rot away unnoticed and unread, somehow no Christian of the second century having any access to them or showing any interest in them. Neither is a particularly attractive hypothesis. A conspiracy to suppress vast quantities of information is perhaps least attractive of all. Yet the alternative must be that Jesus was an uninfluential, unimpressive, unknown rabbi whom no one of any note noticed, and who made no significant impression on any literate person who ever saw or met him, and attracted no literate person into his circle of disciples or admirers. A person of such actual insignificance as not to resemble in the least the Jesus portrayed in the Gospels. An unsavory conclusion indeed, yet what else can we suppose? On the other hand, this vastly peculiar absence of documents is readily explicable if there was no historical Jesus about whom any such documents would be written, but instead only a small mystery cult targeting primarily illiterate converts and aiming to keep the bulk of its teachings secret, and thus off the books, as it were, from whom later churches diverged so greatly in aims and ideology that they had no desire to preserve more than a minuscule selection of the original documents, a mere handful of letters, from the movement's earliest missions, then forged a great many more to suit their needs instead, as we saw in Elements 11 to 14 and Element 44. Or we could resort, in either case, to noting again the great disruption in the church's transmission of authority and information in the middle of the first century, as in Element 22, and posit a third option for the historicist, that this great disruption resulted in the loss of nearly all the documents there may have been. But that requires granting that so awesome a destruction and loss of records really did occur, and was really that incredibly pervasive, even spanning three continents and dozens of cities, which I suspect scholars will find even more unsavory than options one and two. All of these options, whether one, two, or three, or the denial of historicity, have consequences that must be accepted and not ignored. You have to pick one. Because if you don't like the consequences of it, you can only avoid them by picking another. And that is going to pin you down, hemmed in on all sides by undesirable consequences. The most desperate and implausible move is number four, to explain the absence of such writing among the disciples and apostles of Jesus as an apocalyptic disinterest in creating a written record, on which I'll have more to say in chapter 11. Because if we grant such a disinterest, then we cannot explain the letters of Paul, which not only in their very existence refute such disinterest, but whose contents betray on every page the continuing need for writing things down and transmitting and preserving them in physical rather than oral form, which likewise leaves us unable to plausibly explain why only Paul wrote letters. No other missionary for the whole first three decades of the cult spread ever wrote any letter to anyone anywhere? What about the letters we know the churches wrote to Paul, as for example in 1 Corinthians 7 verse 1? We would then also have to dispense with the idea that there was any effort to preserve the story of Jesus orally either, for any interest in the latter would entail an interest in the former. If preserving his sayings and narratives accurately was at all valued by anyone, they would have been recorded in writing early and often, so that missionaries would have aids to memory and church leaders a means to control doctrine, a key need evinced throughout the letters of Paul, as we saw in Element 21. As well as a means of leaving communities and congregations with accurate information to rely upon and meditate on after their departure, since, as Paul's letters attest, the apostles were not always present among every active congregation, yet disputes and questions constantly arose. These needs would be just as pressing in the face of a looming apocalypse, as again, Paul's letters attest, as well as simple common sense. In other words, historicists cannot claim the Christians strove to accurately preserve information while simultaneously claiming that they saw no need to accurately preserve information. It can only be one or the other. Thus, there are only a few possibilities with any respectable chance of being true. Either all the evidence of the first decades of Christianity was actively and very successfully suppressed, or it was uncontrollably and very thoroughly lost despite every desire to preserve it, or Christianity was so small, insignificant, and pervasively illiterate that such evidence never existed, and Paul was a lone educated freak in a sea of illiterate country hicks spinning yarns far and wide. You may choose the one you prefer, but you must then accept the actual consequences of that being true. First among them is the fact that we simply cannot claim to know the story and teachings of Jesus even the minutest fraction as reliably or well as we do those of Socrates. And yet, even for Socrates, every expert concurs that we do not know his story and teachings with superlative reliability. Plato's dialogues, for example, are universally regarded as predominantly a fiction promoting the views of Plato rather than Socrates. Indeed, Plato himself entitles those dialogues a peirasticos, fiction. If such is the state of our knowledge of Socrates, our knowledge of Jesus must be regarded 1,000 times less. Section 3. Missing Evidence. The obvious and usually cited writers on first-century Judean affairs are Nicholas of Damascus, who died around 10 AD, official court historian of Herod the Great, although, of course, all he could have attested to are any famous events relating to the birth of Jesus, which pretty much everyone already agrees aren't historical. And Justus of Tiberias, King Agrippa's personal secretary. The same Agrippa of Acts 25 to 26, before whom we're told Paul goes on trial and procures an appeal to Nero in Rome. And commander also of armies in the Jewish War of 66 to 70, who then wrote a history of that war, including the century of Judean affairs leading up to it. Justus was a primary source for Josephus' own account of that war, and thus is the most likely source for his accounts of messiahs in this period, as we saw in Element 4. Yet we know from a later Christian reader that he never mentioned Jesus or Christianity. We do not have the works of Nicholas or Justus, but we have the works of Josephus, who used them as sources, and we can safely conclude that if either author had mentioned anything about Christ, Christians, or Christianity, later Christian authors would have preserved at least mention of it, if at the very least to rebut it, or make note of their attestation to Jesus or early Christians or Christianity. And these would not have been the only writers covering Judean affairs at the time. They're just the ones we happen to have mention of, because Josephus employed them. There were numerous other writers we know about from that same century who could plausibly have mentioned Christianity and its claims, and such texts or mentions, we would normally expect, would surely have been preserved by later Christians, even if only to rebut or correct them. Philo is the most obvious example, a prolific Jewish author who wrote in Alexandria, Egypt, at the very time Christianity was taking root there. My bookshelf copy of his complete works in English extends to 900 pages of multi-columned small type, which isn't even complete. Many of his works were not preserved. And though what we have is mostly theology and exegesis, he commented a lot on Jewish sects and Jerusalem and Judean interests. Philo made pilgrimages to Jerusalem and knew about Palestinian affairs and wrote about the Herods and Pontius Pilate. And Christians must have begun evangelizing the Jewish community in Alexandria almost immediately. It was the single largest population center with a large and diverse Jewish community, almost directly adjacent to Judea, along a well-established trade route well-traveled by Jewish pilgrims. So it's not as if Philo would not have heard of their claims, even if he had never left Egypt, and yet we know he did, having traveled to Judea and Rome. Moreover, Philo just happens to be the one Jew of the period whose work Christians bothered to preserve. He would not have been alone. There was also all manner of other first-century Jewish literature and apocrypha, most not preserved or not discussing the first century, but there surely had to have been Jewish writing about Christians or early Judea, even if we no longer know of it. It cannot be claimed Jews were uninterested in writing about their own places and times. It's outright contradictory to suppose Jews showed such sustained, even international, interest in suppressing Christianity from its very beginning, if we trust Acts at all on this point, and were its first principal targets for evangelization in Judea and all across the diaspora, as again Acts claims, depicting Christians preaching in its synagogues everywhere, yet never saw occasion to ever once write anything about it, contrary to what we're told in Acts 9 verses 1 to 2, where Paul is said to have had, and to have sent, letters from the Jewish elite explaining why Christians were outlaws. And yet, we have not one surviving citation. We must conclude Christians actively avoided preserving any of it, not even rebuttals of it, not even so much as a mention of it. We know of countless pagan writers who might have written something on all this too. Marcus Velleius Paterculus sketched a history of the Romans from their mythic past up to the year 29 AD, of which parts survive. And King Juba of Mauritania did the same up to around the year 20, none of which survives, although these weren't as likely to mention anything pertinent as Marcus Servilius Nonianus, who lived between 2 BC to 59 AD, and who we know wrote a dedicated history of the first century up to at least the year 41. We also know Pamphila of Epidaurus wrote 33 volumes of historical notes up to her own time, around 60 AD. We know Aufidius Bassus, who died around 60 AD, then a much admired writer, wrote a history up to at least the year 31, and Pliny the Elder, who died around 79 AD, had written a monumental 31-volume history continuing where Bassus left off, hence from around the year 31 to at least beyond Nero's reign, so roughly an entire volume for each year, which could hardly have omitted mention of Christians, such as their supposedly rather public persecution under Nero in 64, as we noted in Element 22, unless they were truly insignificant and thus not even prominently known as the victims of Nero in 64, which in turn means he would surely have made note of Christian beliefs or any famous or amazing claims surrounding Jesus, if there really were any. And yet, we can be fairly certain Pliny did not mention Christians at all. We also know that Cluvius Rufus, ex-consul and Nero's personal Herod in the mid-first century, having served in the Senate since the 30s, wrote a detailed history of events during the reign of Nero, beginning with the reign of Caligula in the year 37 and continuing past Nero up to the reign of Otho in the year 69. This surely would have discussed Nero's persecution of Christians in 64, which would have required a digression on Jesus and Christianity, which in turn would likely touch on the relevant details of the appellate case of Paul before Nero in 62, if that even happened, and what was claimed in that case, and how it degenerated into the execution of scores, if not hundreds of Christians, just a couple of years later, for the crime of burning the city of Rome. Surely the single most famous event of that or any adjacent year. There were also the memoirs of Julia Agrippina, Nero's mother, Caligula's sister, and Claudius's wife, which Tacitus employed as a source. She was assassinated by Nero in 59, too early to report on events of 64, but her work must have covered events up to at least 54, Nero's accession. She was born in 15, and her close position to Caligula and Claudius makes it reasonable to expect she might have mentioned Christianity if it were at all significant. For example, if the Crestus event under Claudius really did have anything to do with Christ, as we'll question later. We know Petronius wrote in 66 AD, just before his own death, a treatise against Nero's entire reign, which could not have failed to ignore the fire and persecution of 64 and any necessary digressions on the Christian story that that would have required. We know Fabius Rusticus wrote a history during Nero's reign that covered events up to his own time, which may have gotten as far as his death or at least the persecution, and at any rate covered events under Augustus and Tiberius and Claudius, and thus would very likely have noticed Christianity as well, if it was notable at all. If any of these authors I've surveyed up to this point had mentioned any of these things, it's hard to believe that no Christian would ever know of it, neither quoting it nor citing it, not even to rebut anything it may have said that was unfavorable to them. And equally hard to believe that no pagan critic of Christianity ever noticed it either, nor made any use of it, not even to answer it or attack it if it was at all favorable to Christians, or to use it against them if it wasn't. To the contrary, we should expect Christians or their critics to have made notice of anything these authors said about Christ or Christianity, whether to use it or to rebut it. So did none of these authors even notice Christianity at all? Or was everyone in antiquity, Christians and their critics alike, wholly disinterested in what they said about it? It has to be one or the other. Take your pick. We know emperors Vespasian and Titus also published commentaries on their own government service, including their prosecution of the Jewish War, these being among the sources, again, that Josephus used. So if Christians ever significantly came up in their invasion and conquest of Judea, or in their government of Rome, they would have mentioned it too. We know Seneca the Elder wrote a history of Rome that covered events from the 1st century BC to around 40 AD. Then Seneca the Younger wrote a treatise on superstition, sometime between 40 and 62 AD, that lambasted every cult known at Rome, even the most trivial or obscure, including the Jews, but never mentioned Christians, an omission Augustine later struggled to explain. As Augustine wrote, Seneca, quote, also found fault with the Jews, but the Christians, however, he did not dare to mention, either for praise or blame, lest, if he praised them, he should do so against the ancient custom of his country, or perhaps, if he should blame them, he should do so against his own will, end quote. Each a rather lame excuse for his silence. And that despite the fact that this Seneca was the brother of the same Gallio whom Christians are brought on trial before in Greece according to Acts 18 verses 12 to 17. Gallio was the governor of that province in the early 50s. Likewise, the Jewish historian Josephus was the personal friend of the same Agrippa before whom Christians went on trial according to Acts 25 and 26. Works in later centuries are relevant as well, for they could have cited or quoted sources from the first century, but as we know, none did, or at least none that we have do. We know that just after the dawn of the second century, for example, Pliny the Younger's friend Pompeius Saturninus wrote histories that Pliny highly regarded, which likely covered the first century. And in the middle of the second century was Aulus Claudius Carax, author of a universal history, still known and read into Byzantine times, but no longer extant. Since he had an infamous penchant for digressions on the fabulous, we should expect him to have mentioned Jesus or Christianity, and thus perhaps quoting or referencing earlier sources on them. But if he did so, no Christian ever noticed, not even in the whole of the Byzantine era, when his works were widely read by Christians for centuries. And we know in the 3rd century, Marius Maximus wrote biographies of all the emperors in the 2nd century, in which he notoriously included extensive quotations of official documents. So, in a century that saw several imperial engagements with Christianity, it is astonishing he never had occasion to mention or digress on the origins or treatment of Christianity. Also in the 3rd century, we know Publius Herennius Dexippus wrote a history of the world from mythical times to his own day, and Gaius Asinius Quadratus wrote a history of Rome from its founding in the 8th century BC, also up to the 3rd century AD. He also wrote a history of Parthia, which could have covered notable events in Edessa or Damascus. The only thing comparable that survives is the sweeping history of Rome by Dio Cassius, who likewise covered the history of the whole Roman Empire from the city's founding to his own time, the early 3rd century AD. His material for the years Jesus lived includes discussion of Judean affairs, but no Jesus or Christians or Christianity. Granted, those sections are sometimes either abridged or fragmentary, but a complete abridgment was made by Christians, who thus would have preserved, even if to alter or correct, any notable information about Jesus or Christianity. For example, in his epitome, Xiphilinus pauses to complain about the fact that Dio doesn't mention Christians being responsible for the rain miracle of Marcus Aurelius, and rectifies this oversight by inserting the Christian version of the legend as known to Xiphilinus, then resuming his abridgment. And Dio's history meticulously proceeds year by year, so its silence is certainly significant, even more so considering what Christians may have deleted from it, as we'll see shortly. Of perhaps lesser significance, but still illustrative of the kind of literature being produced in the 1st century, of which we now have only a small fraction, is Valerius Maximus, whose Memorable Deeds and Sayings, which we have, written around the year 32, compiles records of memorable deeds and sayings, usually of Romans, sometimes of foreigners, to show how Romans were more impressive. Anything amazing about Jesus being popularized at the time could have been entered as a memorable deed or saying, even if he tried to one-up it with a Roman story. It's unlikely he would have known of any, but how many other authors in the 1st and 2nd century were compiling similar collections of amazing stories? We know Phlegon did, in the mid-second century, and he even mentions Jesus, or so we're told, although his information was apparently vague and confused. Phlegon did not connect Jesus with an eclipse and earthquake, however, nor did he relate a resurrection appearance. But there were a lot of collections of amazing stories then, including a whole genre of literature called paradoxography. The several we know about date all the way from the 3rd century BC, for example, Callimachus, Philostephanus, Antigonus of Carystus, Archelaus of Egypt, Myrsilus of Methyma, to the 2nd and 3rd centuries AD, for example, Phlegon, Isigonus, Aelian, including many early forged collections, for example, from Aristotle, Theopompus, Ephorus, all of which would have been only a small fraction of those written, including many satires of the same genre, as for example by Lucian. Tales of Jesus evidently didn't find their way into any 1st century productions of this genre, nor did they appear in any of the Florilegia of the 1st 2 centuries, collections of random commentaries and stories about life, religion, and philosophy in the empire, extant examples of which include, from the late 1st and early 2nd century, the Moralia of Plutarch, and from the 2nd century, the Attic Nights of Aulus Gellius and the Florida of Apuleius, and from the early 3rd century, the Dinner Sages of Athenaeus. Again, these would have been but a fraction of the genre. Nor does any mention survive from any 1st century collection of letters. For example, we have all of Seneca's moral epistles, written in the early 60s, and his collection wouldn't have been the only one made. This represents what was in fact a commonplace literary publishing activity. It just happens to be the only one from the 1st century that medieval Christians chose to preserve, just as Cicero's many volumes of letters is the only collection preserved from the previous century. It was certainly not the only one published from that period either. Nor is there any mention in any of what would have been countless volumes of published speeches from the era. For example, we have the collected speeches of Maximus of Tyre, the same Tyre Jesus supposedly visited according to Mark 3 and Mark 7. From the mid-second century, but he was certainly not the only literate orator in Tyre, even then, much less for all preceding centuries. It's just that the collection of Maximus happens to be the only collection from Tyre that medieval Christians chose to preserve. There would have been many published orators there in the 1st century, likewise in every major metropolis, for Tyre was not the only city with a literary elite publishing books on diverse topics every year. The quantity of literature produced in antiquity was vast, far beyond the minuscule fraction that we now have. and speeches on popular topics were among the genres frequently published, as well as histories and paradoxographies and epistolaries and florilegia, not to forget also poetry, encyclopedias, medical and technical literature, and so on. Satire was also a huge and popular genre at the time. Lucian, for example, mocked or satirized several religions, including Christianity. And though he wrote in the late 2nd century, there would have been many satirists like him in the preceding century, even earlier than Juvenal, who in the early 2nd century satirized numerous religious and philosophical targets, but never found cause to mention Christians, unless he did so in a section now deleted. In the 1st century, we have the fragmentary remains of the Satyricon of Petronius, which mocks several religions in its narrative, even poking fun at crucifixion, but never finds occasion to mention Christ, Christians, or Christianity. In fact, none of the early pagan religious novels mentions Christians, despite involving adventures across the whole empire with frequent encounters with religious cults. But satires were even more common. Aulus Persius Flaccus was a Roman satirist under Nero, from whom nothing survives, but it's possible he would have found opportunities for satire of, if not Christians, then Nero's treatment of them. Lucilius also wrote satirical poems under Nero, including lampoons of religious practices, and once on how Nero burned a robber alive in an amphitheater. So again, he might have had opportunity to lampoon Christians or Nero's treatment of them. Turnus was likewise a late 1st century satirist who could have lampooned Christians if he ever noticed any. And again, these are just among the authors we know about. For any single one of these authors I've named in this whole survey, there is surely some probability that they just happened not to mention either Christ, Christians, or Christianity, though in some cases, as I've noted, that probability might be low. But the probability that none of them would is quite low. For example, if the probability of any one of them mentioning Christ, Christians, or Christianity is a mere 1 in 20, then the probability that none of them would do so is less than 1 in 3. Yet these are only the authors we know about. In fact, not even that. These are only the authors who just happen to have received entries in the Oxford Classical Dictionary, which certainly does not catalog more than a small fraction of all the authors we have surviving evidence of. And the number of actual authors and books written in that period is at least an order of magnitude, if not many orders of magnitude, greater than the number we have any surviving reference to. And the latter will already be several times the number of authors I just enumerated. So the probability that none of what must have been at least 200 relevant 1st century writers would mention anything, if each had only a 1 in 20 chance of doing so, is nearly 30,000 to 1 against. Pretty long odds. Now, 200 is only my estimated count of 1st century authors writing books that have a relevant possibility of mentioning Christ, Christians, or Christianity. In other words, with an odds of a mention equal to 1 in 20, based on the list I just enumerated and how much of an undercount it must be of comparable works written in the same period. By contrast, the actual number of authors in the 1st century would have been in the thousands. For example, if in the Roman Empire there were 100 major cities with a literary elite, and there were at least that many, and only 10 authors published in each city every 10 years, an enormous undercount, being only one book each year per city, then for any given century, there would be 10,000 published authors in that century, producing an average of some 100,000 titles. And again, even that may be an enormous undercount. It's often not appreciated how much literature we have lost from the ancient world. Of course, it could be claimed that there were indeed many such mentions, but none were preserved. And that may even be true. In the case of Jewish and Neronian literature, it almost has to be true. It's certainly true for countless other people, fads, and events in the Roman Empire. But none of those people, fads, or events had a massive church devoted to preserving records of its resurrected God, which then became almost solely responsible for preserving all literature whatever. This is why we have 100 times more faith literature from Christians about Christianity, even just from the 1st to 4th centuries, than we do from any other faith group of the period. Only Judaism comes anywhere near a very distant second, and that only because Christians also avidly preserved a lot of Judaica, and because apart from Christianity, Judaism is the only religious community to continuously survive from the Roman Empire to the present. Even papyrological finds are hugely skewed by this fact, as papyri pertaining to Christianity or Judaism are worth a great deal more on the black market and thus are far more likely to surface or gain any attention. Just contrast the money, time, and resources that have been devoted to the Nag Hammadi and Qumran caches of Christian and Jewish texts, respectively, with that devoted to recovering the pagan library at Herculaneum, which after 200 years still remains almost entirely unexcavated. And yet, many Christian scholars, such as Origen and Eusebius, were particularly keen on referencing or quoting authors who attested to Jesus or Christianity, or rebutting unsavory things said about either. Mentions of Jesus in first-century pagan or Jewish literature would therefore have had the highest probability of preservation of anything written in the whole of antiquity, either outright, as, for example, some have suggested that the works of Tacitus and Josephus were preserved by medieval Christians simply because they contained references to Jesus, or in quotation, paraphrase, or rebuttal. Even then, of course, not everything would be certain to survive. Maybe even a lot of it would still have been lost. But it seems very unusual that absolutely nothing survived. A clue to this strange silence lies in the treatment of the few critical writings about Christians we do know about. Every single one of them was destroyed. The only reason we know anything about them is that in each case Christian authors either refer to them or wrote a rebuttal, and later Christians liked those rebuttals so well that they kept them. But these critiques cannot possibly have been the only ones written, and are unlikely to have been the earliest ones written. And in any event, they are not preserved. They were replaced instead with Christian propaganda. These known cases include an extensive treatise by the Epicurean philosopher Celsus, a friend of Lucian's, in the mid-second century. His attack on Christianity was jokingly entitled The True Logos, inspiring Origen's extensive rebuttal. Around the same time, Fronto, the teacher, friend, and correspondent of Emperor Marcus Aurelius, wrote something like a Discourse Against the Christians, we're unsure of its exact title, which inspired the Christian Minucius Felix to write the propagandistic Octavius in response. A century later, Hierocles wrote The Lover of Truth, summarizing several critical treatises on Christianity up to his time, including a chapter comparing Jesus to Apollonius of Tyana, using the then-recent publication of The Life of Apollonius by Philostratus. Notably, this one chapter is the only part that Eusebius bothers to attack in his Treatise Against Hierocles, which in turn is pretty much the only reason we know Hierocles' book existed. Eusebius even says he ignored the rest of Hierocles' book as being derivative of previous Christian critics, whom, of course, excepting Celsus and Fronto, we know next to nothing about. Later in the 3rd century, the Neoplatonist Porphyry wrote his own 15-volume treatise Against the Christians, which again does not survive, except for diverse scattered quotations in later Christian authors. A century after that, Emperor Julian, the last pagan emperor, himself taking the throne only after a long line of Christian emperors, wrote Against the Galileans, his own critique of the religion that had transformed the empire he inherited. Once again, this does not survive. All we have are portions of Cyril of Alexandria's treatise Against Julian. Eunapius then wrote in the year 414 a History Against the Christians, perhaps not literally named that, but it was regarded as such by later Christians. It was an extensive critique of Christian versions of historical events from 270 to 404 AD. This, too, does not survive. His otherwise inoffensive Lives of the Sophists was preserved instead. The only reason we know of his anti-Christian work is that before it faded into oblivion, many later historians, including Christians, employed it as a source. Again, these are just the ones we know about, which would be a fraction of what there was. All of it was tossed out or destroyed. Instead, we get to read only what medieval Christians wanted us to read. Another example of this phenomenon is that of the mysterious lacuna. Several texts that were preserved have sections removed. Sections whose disappearance seems convenient for Christians. Now, a lot of ancient literature, indeed arguably most, has missing material. This is typically a result of carelessness and accident multiplied by time. But in some cases, the precision and location of what was lost is a bit more peculiar than chance accident would suggest. For example, the Christian scholar Hippolytus, in the early 3rd century, wrote his Refutation of All Heresies in 10 volumes. At the end of the first of them, he says, he will next explain the secret doctrines of the several mystery religions, which would have included the passion narratives of the different savior gods, including miraculous births, deaths, and resurrections, and their sacred meals and baptisms, as we noted in elements 11 to 14 and 31, and what they teach about the things in outer space, which would have included such material as we noted in elements 34 to 38. And then he would describe the teachings of the astrologers. But the second and third volumes are missing. The text skips directly to volume 4, which begins his discourse on astrology. This does not look like an accident. Some Christian or Christians decided to destroy those two volumes, for some reason fearing their contents. The resulting loss in our knowledge of the mystery religions is beyond considerable. Another strange loss concerns the annual festival of Romulus, in which his death and resurrection were reenacted in public passion plays, as I noted in chapter 4. That festival was held on the 7th of July. At the beginning of the 1st century, Ovid wrote an elaborate poem called the Fasti, describing all the festivals throughout the year at Rome, and what went on in them and why. This only survives in its first half, covering January to June. The remaining months are lost. It seems strange that the text cuts off precisely before the month in which a passion play is described that was the most similar to that of Jesus Christ. The fact that we have other descriptions of this festival, albeit none as complete as Ovid's would have been, does mean there was no organized conspiracy to doctor the record, except when it came to controlling faith literature, for which we have clear evidence of Christians actively eliminating disapproved gospels, for example. But this, along with all the other cases, those I've noted and more that I will note, indicates a common trend among individual Christians to act as gatekeepers of information, suppressing what they didn't like, which collectively destroyed a lot of information. Another example, along similar lines, is a mysterious gap in the text of Plutarch's Moralia, a huge multi-volume library of treatises on diverse subjects. In one of these, the Table Talk, Plutarch is discussing the equivalence of Yahweh and Dionysus, and linking Jewish theology to the mystery religions, when, suddenly, the text is cut off. We have no idea how much is missing, although the surviving table of contents shows there were several sections remaining on other subjects besides this one. If an accident, this seems like a very convenient one. A similar mysterious gap is found in the Annals of Tacitus. The text of the Annals survives in only two manuscript traditions, one containing the first half, the other the second half, with a section in between missing, and thus its loss is explicable. But there is another gap in the text that is harder to explain. 2 whole years, from the middle of 29 AD to the middle of 31. That the cut is so precise and covers precisely those 2 years is too improbable to posit as a chance coincidence. The year 30 was regarded by many early Christians as the year of Christ's ministry and crucifixion, as I noted in element 7. Robert Drews analyzed all the gaps in the Annals and concluded that this one has no more plausible explanation than that Christians excised those 2 years out of embarrassment at its omission of any mention of Jesus or associated events, like the world darkness reported in the Synoptic Gospels. Tacitus digresses on Christianity in his coverage of the year 64 in such a way that guarantees he made no mention of it earlier, if the passage there is authentic. Although Tacitus surely must have discussed other events under Pontius Pilate. So we can be certain Christians weren't trying to hide anything embarrassing said about Jesus, but the embarrassment of saying nothing was evidently enough to motivate their targeted destruction of the corresponding text. A similar mysterious gap exists in the Roman history of Cassius Dio. All the years from 6 to 2 BC are gone. There is evidence from remarks elsewhere that Dio discussed Herod's death in this period. A Christian would have expected Dio to discuss the slaughter of the innocents and the miraculous star and other amazing events surrounding the birth of Jesus, and Dio's silence on all of these might have been just as embarrassing as the silence of Tacitus. That this loss might be no accident is suggested by the fact that it is quite thorough. Even subsequent epitomes exclude it, combined with the coincidence of the date. The gap beginning exactly 2 years before Herod's death, in accordance with Matthew 2, verse 16, and ending 2 years after it for good measure, there being at the time some uncertainty among Christians as to when exactly Herod died. What about Dio's treatment of the year 30? Yes, something is mysteriously missing around there, too. In the middle of volume 58, covering the years 29 to 37 AD, we have a reference to an event in book 58, section 17, paragraph 2, that was evidently described in a section that had to have been deleted somewhere between book 57, section 17, paragraph 8, the year 15, and book 58, section 7, paragraph 2, the year 30. Might it have been a section also mentioning Judean affairs, whose silence was again considered too embarrassing to retain?